Well, this is going to be great.
Welcome to the White House Pod with David A.
I am so excited for today. We have an amazing guest, someone that I absolutely love, adore, who's a rock star, an unbelievable career. My gosh, I have like 9 pages here to introduce this man, where normally you only have 1, but no, this man needs 9. That's how his career spans. And I'm just super excited to introduce him. Brian Bosworth, also known as The Boz, is here with us today. How you doing, buddy?
Good. I think the reason you have 9 pages is I've hit the reset button about 34 times. So when you get to start over, you get to turn the page and start writing again.
I mean, you've had such a colorful career. I've had the pleasure of knowing you, I think, like 10 years now, because The Boz set foot on said yes to a little script that we did called Revelation Road 10 years ago. And you've changed my life ever since. It has never been the same. And so,
hopefully for the better.
It is for the better. All right. Yeah. So let's just start here. Brian Bosworth, where do you come from? Are you from Texas? Are you from Oklahoma? Are you from another planet? Because the strength that runs in you is, you know, Thor wasn't even around at the time, but, you know, he would be like the Boz.
I'm sure my parents must have thought I was an alien dropped down. But I'm an Oklahoma boy, Oklahoma born, bred, held captive in Texas when I was in school. So went back to school at the University of Oklahoma for my college experience. But I've always kind of claimed that I'm a simple farm kid that just, you know, have been blessed time and time again, despite myself. Oklahoma kid.
Oklahoma kid. So what part of Oklahoma? See, I was born in Tulsa, by the way. So I grew up as an OU Sooner fan. And I grew up watching this guy running around sacking quarterbacks left and right, and had the best haircut ever.
Ever.
Did things that no one had ever seen before, which was yours truly right over there, Mr. Boz. Okay, so yeah, what part of Oklahoma?
Born in Oklahoma City, but when I say I'm a farm kid, my grandparents had a farm in Meeker, Oklahoma, a very small town that time has really stopped in, because every time you go back there, there isn't really much progress. I think they like it like that because it's just a very simple existence. Funny story, you know, when I was young, like I said, I was held hostage down in Texas when my parents moved down there. My joy in life, I guess my release was being able to play sports, and I desperately wanted the men in my life that I really respected and looked up to. My grandfather was one of the guys on the top of that list to just come down and watch me play. You know, just any kid just wants acknowledgement from those that support and love him. And my granddad could never really leave the farm because it was a working farm, and everything that they put on that farm, everything that came off that farm was either on their plate or in the refrigerator. So they lived a very simple existence, but he made it clear that he couldn't leave the farm. But if I was ever good enough, there's a little school that was down the street. And then if I made it to that school, that he would come watch me play. And that little school was University of Oklahoma. And that was in like 1974, just when Oklahoma had won the first of a back-to-back championships in the 70s. So I made it my mission, and I promised him that I would make it to that school. And dedicated a lot of my time and energy to get there. Unfortunately, he passed away when I was 13, but I know he was there watching me in spirit. Grandmother was able to come watch me play several of my games while I was playing there.
I think everybody wants to know, you know, when you you started playing football, how old were you?
I was 5 years old.
5 years old. Okay. So it wasn't like
it was either that or they were going to, Dad was going to have to hire a full-time construction engineer to come in and fix the house from all the drywall and the fence getting torn down and, you know, the drawers getting pulled out, stuff like that.
Did you have brothers?
I was a hell yeah.
Brothers or sisters?
I had two sisters.
Okay, so.
I tormented them.
Oh, were you the oldest? Where do you fall on the spectrum?
I was the youngest.
Okay.
I was the youngest, but they were my quote unquote punching bags.
Oh,
you know,
my
gosh. My frustration. Yeah, it was terrible.
Okay.
I mean, I really felt bad about it.
Okay. Do they still love you today?
One, no. The other one tolerates me.
I doubt that. I think everybody loves Brian Bosworth today. Okay, all right. So you're 5 years old. You start going into football. Like, at what point in time do you realize that you're really good? Like, were you tall and strong early on, or did you grow later, or did you grow like ahead of everybody? Like, where was your growth pattern?
I think I was right in the middle of average. You know, when I was. Playing my first experience, you know, playing, you know, I was the offensive center, and I played defense. But I think back in those, this was at the YMCA, and it was full pad, you know, contact football. I don't know if they do that anymore at 5 years old. I think they've kind of curtailed that to where the kids are may go through, you know, some flag football and some 7-on-7 campaigns and stuff. So probably help keep them from getting concussions at an early age. But yeah, I don't think I realized that I was talented in football until probably 3 or 4 years later when they moved me to running back, and suddenly I was scoring touchdowns and, you know, kind of the leader of the team. But I spent most of my time passionate about soccer. I just really loved soccer. I scored all the goals and put me at center forward. And back then, the game wasn't that, you know, strategic. It was just like, you know, the fullback kicked the ball over the center line, and the forward outrun the fullback from the other team and muscle mile away and kick it past the goalie that probably couldn't move very athletically. So, you know, I enjoyed that sport. And then basketball was probably my second. Football was probably my third. Only because, you know, it takes a while for you to – I guess get comfortable with the hitting, disbursement of hits and absorption of hits, and just being okay with playing with kids that were older and bigger. Because back in those years, when you're young, you know, there's like usually a 2-year gap, and it was segregated by generally kids that had more weight. So the older kid, you know, if he was 20, 30 pounds heavier, he couldn't carry the ball, but he could be a lineman. But, you know, kids, when they range from 7 to 10, you know, you can get all shapes and sizes, you know. So it really doesn't equal out until you start to get into junior high and high school.
Okay, so when you're in junior high, you're 7th grade, are you starting on their – did they have varsity in junior high? I guess so,
Not junior high, but I will say junior high was probably the the beginning of a challenging campaign for me mentally and spiritually, because of my behavioral patterns in elementary school and even in kindergarten and preschool, I was that wild kid that was solely disruptive. I was down in the principal's office multiple times a day, getting corporal punishment. Back in those days, you're getting licks. I mean, they had to paddle out, and I was getting licks multiple times a day. It got to the point where the teacher wouldn't even say my name. She would just point to the door, and I knew what that meant. You know, let's go, going down to the principal's office. But once I got into junior high school, our junior high started at 6th grade. It was the first year they had started as brand new junior high school. So 6th grade, I was not under the coach's tutelage. I was still being coached by my father. So all my influence and control was being really controlled by him. At the end of 6th grade, my behavioral patterns hadn't changed, but the coach that was in charge of all of the athletics at our junior high school, 7th and 8th grade there at Sam Houston, he came to me and said, "Hey, look, I understand you're a great athlete, but unfortunately, I'm not going to invite you to participate in sports here at the school simply because of the fact that you're a problem child." And I knew that was going to be devastating. To me, I was trying to absorb it, but my concern was, how was I going to translate that conversation to my father and then have
Wow.
And lovingly, you know, say, ah, it's okay, you know, we'll get through it. You know, that wasn't his mentality. So that was the first night that I actually prayed and said, I don't know what's wrong with me. God, please, you know, I want to be good. I don't know how to be good. I don't know how to control this little Tasmanian devil that sits inside me. But I really wish that I had the capacity to control this. And I went to the coach the very next day and I begged him, just give me one chance. You know, I think we had a few weeks left in the school year. And he said, I'll give you to the end of the school year. If you don't have any more disruptions, we can revisit this during the summertime. So it kind of lit a fire under me to start to, you know, look for other, you know, places to gain some wisdom and some direction.
Okay, so let's just skip to high school. You're a freshman in high school now. Are you able to be on the football team at this moment?
Oh yeah. I straightened up from then on. Okay. I was model student, grade A's.
So you didn't have I take it you didn't have like a Michael Jordan thing where they didn't invite you onto the team because you didn't make the team. Like, did you walk into high school? Were you already reigning head football player of the entire high school? Like, did you have to? I mean, did you have to? Was there a moment where you actually had to try to get better?
Well, I mean, every day was.
I know you got better, obviously, every day. But I'm wondering. I'm wondering at what point, at what moment. Were they like?
When did it separate?
Yeah. When did it separate? When were you above the rest? I say this in the most you would never say this, but I say this like, and everybody's thinking this anyway. So you know that's the question that everybody has written in. That's what they want to know.
Well, I think in those days it was pretty much set in stone. A freshman play on a freshman team, and there were two freshman teams. There's an A and a B, whatever you call it. You know, red and yellow, or red and white is what we call them. But at the end of your freshman year, right before you go into the summer program, they have a spring ball program. And that's really preparing for the following year. As a freshman, I remember laying on the field, stretching, and one of the head coaches that was coaching the varsity came over and he stuck his head inside my helmet vision. And I'm looking up at the sky and I see the man's head and he goes, hey, Boz, we want to invite you to come over to the varsity. And that was that first moment of, hey, somebody must think I'm actually pretty good. Because when you're young, you're still, you know, playing with athletes and they're all competitive and you really don't know how to gauge yourself. You can kind of look.
How big were you at this moment? How big were you at that? Like,
oh, man. I think when I was end of my freshman year, I might have been 5'9", 5'10", maybe 155, 160, you know, dripping wet.
Okay.
And when I started varsity, my very first game in that sophomore year, I was about 5'10", 5'10 and a half, maybe 165 dripping wet. I'd only put on 5 or 6 pounds in that summertime because I didn't know how to train. Nobody, that was all brand new to me as well. But it really came down to the senior that was playing in front of me during fall ball blew his knee out during one of our scrimmages. And it was like I was his backup. And then it was like, okay, well, you're in there. And I was the smallest kid on the defensive line. I played outside defensive end, which is a stand-up position, kind of outside linebacker. But our very first game, I remember we played against the vaulted Highland Park Scots. And they had an offensive line that resembled a pro football team. And a 320-pound kid that was an offensive tackle that I had to play over, you know. And because I learned and listened and worked on my technique, I not only was able to hold my own, but we were able to, you know, show that we, you know, we were going to be a pretty decent team and I was going to be a pretty decent player. And I got sophomore of the year and, you know, all the accolades started coming, but it was because of the work ethic and the time and the coach's support and all that surrounded me at that time that gave me the confidence to say, hey, I think I'm pretty good. I just need to keep grinding and keep my head down and keep working. I got a long way to go, but I got a pretty good start.
Now you go, obviously you get a ton of accolades all the way through high school. At what point in time, you know, your senior year, Are you injury free through high school, or did some injuries start to creep in at that point?
Oh, there was some stupid stuff that I did, you know, prior to my senior year. I told my father that I would not ride motorcycles anymore. I was a kid that used to get on dirt bikes, you know, and I would terrorize the neighborhood. So at some point in time, there was an incident where he had a bigger bike and I wanted to ride it. And, you know, a couple of girls that were friends, you know, said, "Hey, would you come pick me up? We want to, you know, go to the store and get some candy or whatever." "Sure, I want to be the hero." So I come and pick them up, both of them on the back of my bike, going down the street. And, you know, I'm probably 14, 15 years old, no business being on the street, not even a street bike. And, you know, I get kind of run over by a big truck. One of the girls falls off. Another girl gets stuck under the bike with me. And yeah, the bikes were sold there pretty quickly after. And then I told my father at that point in time, so I'll never get on another bike until my career is over. And then right before my senior year started, a buddy came in with one of those brand new murder cycles. And I just fell in love with it. And I was working at a kind of a Home Depot kind of store. And it just had started raining. And I said, "I just want to take it down the street, turn around, and come. I just want to feel, you know, how it feels underneath you." So he let me do it. And, you know, I come back in the parking lot and I downshift. Don't break a downshift. And the bike slides up underneath me. And I'm so panicked that it's a brand new bike. I'm trying to hold on to it. So I stayed underneath it and chewed my whole foot up. This is like 2 weeks before starting my senior year. And I knew my dad was going to be just completely upset. I remember being in the emergency room and they were scrubbing my foot with some sort of, I don't know, Brillo pad, trying to get the asphalt out of it. And I was in a wooden shoe for about a week. And then I started to learn how to run again. So yeah, I was injured, but not on the field. I was only injured because this is my self stupidity.
All right.
So I played pretty much injury free. I was very blessed by being injury free.
And now going into OU, you knew exactly where you wanted to go, right?
I knew that was a dream because, like I said, I made that promise to my dad or my grandfather. Like most kids coming out of high school, you know, I don't know if they're all this way. Maybe a little bit less now because of all the media attention that they get, because we didn't have these ratings, you know, that are afforded these kids today. But I had a lot of doubt about how good I really was. My senior year, we were 2 wins and 10 losses. We were a terrible, terrible football team.
But the defense must have been amazing because you were there.
We were you need more than one guy. We had some decent.
Do
players.
You? Do you need more than one guy?
I think you need at least.
When you got the Boz?
I can only cover, you know,
so much part
the
field.
Not all of it.
I bet you tried though to cover the whole thing.
Yeah, I did. And my head coach was not one of those coaches that supported the player.
Yeah,
he did not have that gift. So he basically told me that if I was lucky, I might get looked at from maybe a Division II school.
Wow, you
know, he didn't know that I was getting letters from all over the country. But at that time, when you got a letter from any college, I think they're just sending out form letters to any of the, you know, the all district players and the all metro players and stuff like that, just to kind of cover their bases. I had great visits set up. I went to SMU, committed to them. I went to LSU. I didn't commit to them because the food was going to be problematic for me with that crawfish. Went to Baylor, committed to them. Went to Texas A&M, committed to
them.
Wow,
a lot of commitments.
I was afraid to tell anybody no. But then I Oklahoma was my last visit.
I feel like this is how we ended up, how you said yes to the podcast is yes. You still hold that along. You can't say no. he's like, I didn't really want to be here. Ah, oh, son of a gun. I guess I'll do that.
Well, you know.
All right. How did that? I mean, you said yes to like 9 different colleges. Like,
I said yes to everybody. I really wanted to go to Oklahoma. And the problem was, I looked at Oklahoma's roster and I looked at myself in the mirror and I thought, I don't know that I can break into that roster and be an impact player. I didn't know I could start. I didn't want to go to the school and just stand on the sideline and be just one of those guys. I wanted to, you know, wanted to participate. And I knew at A&M, I felt like, hey, one, it feels like home. And two, I felt like, you know, they weren't Oklahoma. And the expectation was much more manageable for me. So my fear was that I wouldn't be able to meet the expectation that I had for myself and my father had for me, and my, you know, that I know my grandfather wanted me to participate and things like that. So I asked the head man, Coach Switzer, right off the bat when I first got there. I said, "Why are you recruiting? You can have anybody in the country. I'm coming from a, you know, from a 2-10 team, and yet you got all Americans, you know, stacked up, you know, in backup positions." And he challenged me and he said, "Hey, look, you know, I see something in you that nobody else has seen. Nobody else will realize, because I can pull something out of you that you don't know exists. So I just want you to, you know, have confidence in yourself, trust me, and come home." And he used that word, coming home, and it really meant something to me, that phrase, because he knew about my past. He knew about my grandmother. He knew about my grandfather. He didn't know about the promise, but he knew that I had family there, and my roots were there. And I don't think he had any intention of going into any deep thought. I think that was just part of his MO in terms of selling his school and the program. But to me, it registered as something deeper than that.
It's interesting though that you have had, you know, in the midst of obviously your giftedness, that you're still, you know, you have the thoughts of a human of, am I good enough? Am I going to be strong enough? Am I going to be, you know, able to actually play, or am I just going to stand on the sidelines? How long was it after you went to OU? Were you able to start? I mean, did you start right away as a freshman, or did you, or no, how long did it take? First year?
Yeah, I redshirted that first year. The first year I got there in 83, there were two, they were actually first round draft choices, Jackie Shipp and Thomas Benson. They were seniors, and the coaches, we had a really good recruiting class in 83, and they had a really good recruiting class in 82. So they were trying to stockpile some players and redshirt as many as they could. So I didn't, I just kind of shut it down the first year because I knew that there was no chance of me playing. And I don't think I was physically or mentally ready to play, because there is an adjustment period once you get there.
That being said, so how long did it take you before you went in and started?
I started the first game of my second career. So my
sophomore,
my redshirt freshman year. And I always mimicked the,
what does that mean, you know, by redshirting? What do you mean by that? I mean,
when they redshirt you, you basically just go into school. It's a free year of eligibility so that they can capture an additional year. So instead of 4 years of eligibility, you have 5 years of academic eligibility, but you have 4 years still left to play.
Okay.
So I was still considered a freshman. So when they call it a redshirt freshman, that's still your first year of playing. And it was very much like, very much like high school. You know, you go through the season, didn't play, go through spring ball, had to earn my job, so to speak, kind of earn the respect and trust of the coaches. But the coaches did not let you know, where you stood going into the summer. So you have a summer program and you just got to say, hey, I just pin my ears back and I just, you know, I got to do everything I can to make sure that I'm ready. So if I get the call, I'm physically and emotionally ready to step on the field, because it's a pretty big deal. And it wasn't until a week before we were playing the very first scheduled game of my first eligible year, we were playing Stanford, that is very much mimicked when the high school coach came over, stretching on the field. And I see the defensive coordinator's face come into my face mask view, and he just looks down at me and goes, "Boz, you got it. You're our starter," you know, and I just got, you know, full of emotion, because it was like, you know, I finally, you know, have the opportunity to step on the stage. You know, I've got permission. Now it's up to me to do something with it, but I've got permission. So that's when fear really started to creep in big time. It was like, oh my gosh, you know, you got to put up now. It's, you know, no more of that, no more of that making up stuff, you know. you can talk all you want on the sideline, but at some point in time,
Were you a big talker? Obviously, you know, in grade school and everything like that. When you were in high school, were you a big talker?
Yeah.
Like, were you?
I was a big throw up artist at the beginning because I would get so nervous.
Right.
I was talking to my wife about this last night. How kids these days deal with anxiety, and they're just so overwhelmed with what's going on in our world. And I was asking her, I said, it wasn't like that when I grew up. I mean, yeah, we had anxiety and stuff, and yeah, it was stress. You had a big test coming up, you got finals, you got a contest you got to prepare for. But we didn't have medicines, and they didn't call it, some sort of process that you were dealing with. You just got issues. You got to deal with them. You got to fight through. So I remember fighting through them in high school. I'd get so nervous before a game. I would throw up in the locker room. And usually that first series, unfortunately, there was a couple of guys that got a little bit of hurl on them. But until you kind of settle yourself in, it's like, it's too much energy. It just kind of spews out. I didn't throw up in college. I controlled that at that point.
Okay, but were you getting back to this, like your verbiage, you're talking to were you talking to the quarterback, or were you talking to the lineman that you were about to run over, or like were you talking are you on the sideline talking like when do we start speaking here?
I'm gonna say that first game I didn't say much at all, just because I wasn't sure. It was just such an
when you were going in,
experience.
But were you like in high school though? Because you were playing obviously the whole time. Are you talking smack the whole game? Okay. And now what? Now is this like? What kind of smack is this? Is this like? Do we do obscenities or yelling at that? Or are you threatening their parents? Or is it more in the vein of a game? Like, hey, jolly ho, hey, I'm going to run over you with a ho. I don't know. what do we say? Like, what is, for all the listeners out there who really have not had any smack talk to them at all in their life, what would you be saying to them,
Generally, what we would do is we would isolate how a team's success is. So a team's success is either generated by a running back, a quarterback, a wide receiver, a combo of the three. So we would isolate on those guys and try to get into their head. So if I was playing against them in high school, there was really more running back impact than there was quarterback impact, because they spent more time running the football. So we would generally isolate on the tailback, and if we could get him, down where he didn't have a terrific play, we would do a little bit of business on him as we're getting up, use his head for a little bit of extra leverage to make sure that we, pushed him down a little bit. So that,
right.
And we just remind him that we were there to ruin his night at each and every turn, and that his night was probably not going to end up the way he thought it was going to be. So if you want to quit now would be a good time to quit and stop embarrassing yourself, because it's only going to get worse from here.
How did it work? Like, did it work like right away, or did you have to, say a few things? And was it just you, or was everybody chiming in?
Not everybody had the confidence to do that. A lot of them were just, in sheer panic about,
not getting run over.
Because, like our nose guard was maybe 150 pounds.
Okay.
I'm 225 and I'm standing behind him. He can run back in the wind. So he's freaking out. He's on skates.
Okay. So,
so you
flash forward to OU. Now your nose guard is a little heavier in at OU, right? He's now 250, something like that.
Yeah.
280,
yeah.
Whatever they are.
Do we what?
Your nose guard is how much does he weigh in at OU?
I had a great nose guard. Actually, I had a couple of great nose guards. I had Tony Casillas, which was an All-American and a Lombardi Award winner.
How much did he weigh?
He weighed about 275.
Okay, so they're now bigger. And now they're going against other people that are bigger. Where's the language at this point in time when you're does smack talk? Do we call it smack talk, or is there another word for this? Is there a cooler verbiage for this? Would my son just look at me and be like, good Lord, Dad? What do you call it?
You would use a word more like you know, starts with an S and ends with a T.
Yeah.
More than
like
you
a
would
shirt,
smack
like a shirt talk.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
One of those guys.
Okay.
But you know, it ranged. There was.
Was it every game? Like, I mean, let's get into your college career here, I love this because you know, we've been friends for a long time, but I actually did not know a lot of this. I don't think, you know, we've had these conversations too many times. I love the idea of we're shirt talking to the team. Now you're also shaving sides of your head in college, right?
Yeah, but you can't see that from that was just
because
from
you're under a helmet.
Me. Yeah, that was just for me.
Yeah, but we have all kinds of pictures of the Boz, and I'm sure we're going to put these up on the screen right now of when you're on the sideline, and everybody can see your haircut.
Sure, yeah. And I did it that you know I did it so that you know the camera could find me or the camera if they wanted to see something interesting. It's like you know. Haircut. Okay, there's something we don't see every day.
Now, what was it? What happened in your brain that was like, hey, I could stand out in this way? Not only am I shirt talking these people, I'm also, you know, 100% driven in football, but now I'm also going to alter my look a little bit without plastic surgery, of course.
Most of that came as a rebellious act because my father would not allow me to do things like that when I was under his roof. So if it was not ultra conservative, you know, we weren't doing it.
Why did he want you to be ultra conservative in, you know, growing up? Was it because of the God element of, you know, this is how we honor God, or was it more like you're going to be, you know, like a military type of thing?
I think it was more of the latter. He grew up, even though he went to church, I don't know that he was a believer because the actions didn't mimic what you would think there. But I think it was because of the way he was raised by his father, which was not, you know, was not a fatherly love. So his toolbox didn't have the necessary tools to then transition to another father-son relationship and then better that. So he was very strict, extremely strict, and he did not know how to give courage, or he didn't give encouraging words. It was much more of a criticizing role, you know, and since he was my coach all the time, it wasn't a matter of what I did right. It was, here's what you did wrong. I mean, I know you got MVP or you scored all the goals, or you scored a lot of basket. But here's what you did wrong. You did this and you did this. You keep doing this wrong. You keep doing this wrong. So it was just a constant battering of how do I get him to acknowledge the good and, you know, maybe encourage a different way of working on the bad. And so I think it was just, again, rebellious that once I got there, suddenly it's like, and I didn't want to do tattoos. Tattoos were one of those things I don't think was one of those, you know, we didn't do that back in the 80s. Now they do that.
Okay.
I think the things that you could get away with, that if it was a mistake, you could overcome it pretty quickly. Haircut, hair grows in, you know, 2-3 weeks. You get an earring.
Was anybody else doing this at the time, or were you like the first college player that was shaving his head in different ways?
Like probably lightning the only bolts. White guy doing it. Probably the only white guy doing it.
Okay. Were there other
back in the days? Our brother guys would. You know, they'd fade, they'd put fades in their hair, or they, you know, they'd cut it back, you know, in different ways. But I don't, yeah. And my hair kind of evolved organically. It's like I had an idea what I wanted to do. So we just tried little things at a time before it evolved into.
Did you have like a haircut person at the time?
I did.
Lady or a woman or a man? Yeah.
Yeah, Camille Benzo. She was the author of The Boz.
Now, where is Camille today? Do we know? Have we ever seen Camille since like college?
She's around. I haven't seen her for years, but I know she's around. She's married. She's got kids.
Did she have a salon? Did she have her own salon?
Had her own salon right there on Campus Corner. Yeah,
on campus, it was a salon.
Yeah,
it still there?
No, it's not still there. Her father's restaurant was right across the street, Othello's. and she had the little hair salon across the street from the restaurant. And it was really a couple of the other guys had gone down and gotten their hair cut. One of my linebacking buddies, Paul Meliazzo, went down there, and he got a perm. And everybody howled because it's like, dude, you got a perm.
This is the 80s, right?
The 80s.
Which is hilarious because the perms are back. Like, my son has a perm right now, you know, and I'm like, I had one too, you know, in the late 80s. I'm a little bit embarrassed to say, but you never had a perm. You had the coolest hair ever. I got to give it up for Camille. This is the first time I've ever heard that somebody had a hairdresser in college that did something specific that was like, normally you hear about designers, you know, like, oh, this person designed me. Like J-Lo had her thing the other, not J-Lo, Janet Jackson had her thing the other day. And on Entertainment Tonight, they actually had her designer come on and talked about all of her outfits all these years from, like, you know, the 80s all the way through. And it's the same guy. I wonder, like, does Camille follow you around? Camille?
Camille
follow you around, and because your hair,
she got quite famous.
Did she really? Okay,
she was
good.
Quite famous. Everybody in Oklahoma knew that she was. She was the, you know.
Did she do anybody like? Did she do anybody else of that much note of the Boz's hair? Because I mean, that was such a huge thing.
It was like, and it's still alive and well. I mean, generally during high school playoff times, the whole team will go down and they'll cut their hair. So I'll get pictures sent to me all the time of guys that are getting.
Did you ever date a woman that had that hair?
No, but I've seen grandmothers come to Seattle games wearing that, and it's quite shocking.
Did you do that all the way through, just through high school, or did you do it into the pros?
I did it into the pros. Yeah.
Okay.
In college, it was fun because, yeah. It was just right down the street. I could go, you know, tune it up or do whatever during the course of the week. It wasn't that big a deal. But once I got to Seattle, it became like a job. And that's when I really started to realize it's like, this is more than I really wanted. I just wanted to express myself for a little bit of time and separate myself from like everybody else. But I didn't realize when the wild horse runs, if you don't have a good lasso on him, you're going to get drugged for a while before you can get him tamed. And I didn't get him tamed when he was up in Seattle.
All right. So you go, I don't have that much time left, which is just a terrible, terrible tragedy. We're going to have you back, Boz, because we're going to talk about your movie career and everything like that. But first of all, what?
Like I said, you got 9 pages.
I mean, I got 9 pages here, and I feel like I'm only on page one. I haven't even like listed your accolades yet. By the way, okay, so it says you got banned from the Orange Bowl your junior year. Now, I don't know how much can we talk about this, but sure. Have you ever talked about this? I would imagine people asked you about this. I'm fascinated. Was anybody else banned from the Orange Bowl, or just the Boz?
I think there was another player off our team that got banned from it, but there were, I think across the country, there were 8 to 10 players that got banned from their bowl games. And that was the first year in 1986, I believe, that they instituted testing for steroids.
Because so, they hadn't been doing it before. Like, this is just, it was like the first year that they're testing now. Is steroids a thing, though, that like, were a lot of people using it, you know, throughout their college careers? And are they still doing it today? Like, how does that, you know?
Yes, and yes, and yes, and yes. It's changed. The landscape of it's changed. Back in, and I don't know the history of it. And everybody gets introduced to it in their own, you know, in their own way. But I know that it was prevalent, you know, probably more so in the late 70s, early 80s. And the reason for its beginnings, I guess, was the game had become so physical, and it was really about dominating the line of scrimmage and, you know, the strong offensive linemen, and how much bigger and stronger they were getting. So the defensive linemen had to do something to kind of at least even the playing field. For me, I got introduced to it after an injury, and one of the players that had played at Oklahoma had since moved on to the pros, came back, and he had asked me how, you know, how I was doing in the off season. And I kind of explained to him what was going on. And he said, well, you know, I've got a doctor, he helps me, you know, it helps with recovery. So this is just how you do it. You know, the game of college football is rough, but once it gets to the pros, you've got, you know, another six or seven games you're going to play. And it's really about your ability to recover so that you're prepared for the following game. Each and every week is, you know, is a series of car crashes. And, you know, the game was still primarily a physical running game type of game. So, you know, I go to the doctor. The doctor gives me whatever it is that I need, and I recover quicker. I get back on my feet, and then that was the same year that they decided that they want to institute this new policy across the landscape of college football. Coaches come in right before we break for the summer program, and he just says, "Hey, look, I don't care who's on it. Doesn't really count. I don't really care about it. Just if you're on it, get off of it, because when you guys come back for fall, we're going to test all of you guys independently here as a school." Came back, you know, I listened to what the coach says, come back, you know, everybody's tested. A few guys didn't pass, but those are usually the younger kids that are coming in. But, you know, I passed, got through the whole season, no problem, get to the Orange Bowl. I go to a postseason All-American show. I think it was out in L.A. where it's the Bob Hope show. Come back and get food poisoning. I got sent to the infirmary. The next thing I know, the NCAA is there to take a urine sample, and I'd been in the hospital now for 3 days trying to get through the food poisoning, and I couldn't muster up any sample for them. The trainer comes in and says, "Hey, look, if you don't give them something and they leave, then you're out." So I said, "All right, what do I do?" He says, "Drink a bunch of orange juice and give them something." So I drank a whole bunch of juice, and I managed to get in about that much into a cup. It looked like, I don't know, sludge.
Right.
And then next thing I know, about a week later, I get a phone call from coach, and he goes, "Hey, you know, you got popped." I'm going, "Nope, that didn't happen." And he goes, "You're telling me you're not on it?" And I said, "I'm telling you 100% I'm not on anything. Test me." So they test me while I'm there in Dallas. A week after, the test comes back, I'm clean. And I figured, okay, we're going to get this thing cleaned up, you know, and everybody's going to be embarrassed, but, you know, whatever. And they didn't want to fight. They didn't want to go to battle for me. So that kind of was that impetus of wearing that infamous T-shirt, the NCAA, not the National Communists Against Athletes shirt, because they didn't have my back, you know. And yeah, they ended up, I think they put me in a box and they framed me because they needed a poster boy to implement this new process they were doing. They weren't fans of the Boz.
Yeah, so it's one of the blessings and curses of standing out so much.
Yeah,
all right. So you leave college. I'm looking at this. Bosworth was named Sports Illustrated NCAA Football All Century Team, one of the only nine linebackers of the entire squad. Like, what's your favorite award that you have been awarded in your college career?
My favorite accolade is the national championship, because that was a team award, and what we did together as a team to get that award. That's such a hard thing to do as a team, is to win a national championship. But I gotta say probably the Butkus Award, because it identifies me singly as a linebacker, as opposed to, you know, a Heisman.
It's the winner of the first two Butkus Awards is the nation's top college linebacker. He remains the only player ever to have won the accolade more than once.
Yeah.
I mean, amazing.
If I'd have gone back for my senior year, I'd
won it again.
But I'd put money on me that I'd win it again. We were a really good
football team. Are you happy that you get obviously drafted to the pros? That was a big thing. You announced, you know, I think you were one of the highest paid person to go into the pros at the time, weren't you?
At that time. On paper.
Yeah, on paper. I mean, we could see your big house in the background. We know. Your arches, good Lord, we don't have those in California. But like, when you're drafted into because that's another whole thing. Seattle, what did you love most about Seattle? Like, why Seattle?
I mean, I
did honestly, it matter?
It did matter a lot because I had no inclination about Seattle. I didn't really follow
You went number one, right? Didn't you go number one?
It was a supplemental draft. So there were back in those days, you did have an option if you graduated, but you had to graduate that you could enter a supplemental draft, which was a draft that was for specific players that graduated. And it was like a month or two after the regular draft. So you got a little bit more control because then the teams, every team has an opportunity to pick you. And if a team doesn't need that particular position filled, they can pass on you and you can still be, you know, a first rounder because everybody's going to get a shot in the first round. What I didn't count on is that Seattle would pull the ticket first. And it's like when they pulled it, I said, Seattle. I mean, I'm a smart kid. Where is Seattle? That's not geographically smart enough to know that right off the top of my head. And it took me a minute. But I did love the environment when I first flew in. Beautiful, evergreen, you know, the mountains, Mount Rainier and the Mount Olympias, you know, just the water. But when that cloud sets in about mid-October and doesn't leave until like late May or June, it's depressing. It is tough to deal with, especially from somebody who lives in the sun. So that was an adjustment. That
yeah.
was an adjustment.
I mean, okay. So, and you play, when you think back on, like, if you're telling kids today, what does the Boz say to kids as encouragement for football? What's your wise words as we have to wrap up here? Because we're going to come back because we have too much to talk. I got like not eight more pages to go through with the Boz. Not to mention Revelation Road. Hello. We didn't even touch on that show that's coming out that I got to spend a couple months with Boz last year in South Africa. But let's talk about this, though. First of all, for all the kids that are coming up, what do you tell them today? Because I'm sure you still talk to high schools. You talk to everybody.
Yeah, I mean, if I've given an
opportunity your word of advice?
To speak to them, I use this acronym PATH, you know, and I think as I've learned from my mistakes and experiences going through my life, it's understanding that God has a very specific path. And the blessing that you have as an athlete can be removed immediately. So honor that path you're on. And when you break that path down, it's passion, pursuit. Have a great attitude, acknowledge why you're there, be trusting while you're on that path, be truthful while you're up on that path. But probably the most important part of being on the path is, one, have honor and be hungry, but have a humility about yourself that when great success comes, don't float away from being grounded. You have to maintain that through success. There will be challenges, and it's how you react to the challenges, the trials and tribulations, the things that don't go well, is how you balance out the successes. It keeps you even keel as a player, emotionally sound, and then probably more than anything is to listen to your body and be patient with your injuries. Don't push past the noise that is not your support group, because you're going to always have stress on you. Hey, if you're not ready to go, if you're 75 or 80%, not only are you doing your team a disservice by forcing yourself to get up back on the field or court before, you're actually putting your team, you know, at danger of not performing at their peak. But you also put yourself and your career at danger because now you've set yourself up for potential catastrophic injuries. And that's what happened to me. I just wasn't patient, and I was more concerned about letting people down because I just felt like I owed it to them to live up to this expectation that they had of this Boz character that, you know, he's going to be the second coming. He's going to lead us to, you know, the promised land. And there is no one man that I know of, other than the one that we talk about daily, that can actually do that. So, you know, don't forget, we're just human.
I love you, Boz. I hope to have you back. I hope you'll you know. I know you have a problem saying no, so I hope that you'll come back and we can talk about your you know, your whole movie career, because you're fascinating. And I'll see you in Orlando very soon.
Yes,
we'll pub that Rev Road. All righty. Boz, thanks again. I love you,
Take
brother.
Care. All right, man. You too.
Well, Brian Bosworth, the Boz, one of the greatest men that I know. There's so much more to tell you guys. And I hope that we do it again, because we didn't even scratch the surface. All right. Well, I love you guys, and thanks for watching, and God bless you. Have an amazing day wherever it is that you are and whatever you're doing, and bless those around you and make them feel like it is their great day to have you in their lives. All right, God bless you guys. See you next time.